One of the things we found out in this past month or so is that we're going to have a change of life and a change of lifestyle and a change of habits and a change brought on by the 911 thing that was carried on over in New York. I have found that many people do not really understand or have a full enough understanding of the problems we have with the Arabs. And I noticed that the president was very careful when he first mentioned this, and he asked people to join him in a crusade. I never heard him use that word again, and apparently not, because when the Islamic people think of a crusade, they think of the marches that were given. In fact, I understand there were 11 crusades marching toward Jerusalem to save the city from the Saracens, as they were called, that is, the Islamic people. But all of this has an interesting beginning, and I think that you'll find the Bible gives the very source of where this all started. I'd like to have you turn back with me to the book of Genesis, chapter 27. It's rather interesting here when we read of what happened back there, and we find that these things are continuing to be a problem. In the 27th chapter, notice here it begins with we want to begin here in verse 41. It's talking about Esau and Jacob. Esau, as you know, was the oldest son of Isaac, and Jacob was the second born. Esau was a man he was the Marlboro man. He was the one that went out hunting, and he was the one who lived outdoors, and he was a rugged individual. And you find that Jacob was kind of a mama's boy. He stayed inside. He listened to his mother. He was kind of some of them thought he was kind of a sissy. We find out he wasn't. In fact, he was a great conniver. He was one that really could figure out things. But let's take a look at this verse 41. It says, Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father blessed him. See, not only was Jacob given the inheritance, but also the blessing. And that angered Esau. He threatened to kill him. Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are at hand. Then will I slay my brother Jacob. Jacob, of course, is from the Hebrew word Yaakov. It means heel grabber. And when Esau was born, Jacob was right behind him with his hand on his heel. And it's come to mean supplanter, one who takes someone else's place. And this is exactly what Jacob did. Rather strange how in the Bible names mean more than just names. They have a deeper meaning. They're almost prophetic. Verse 42 says, these words of Esau, her elder son, were told to Rebekah. And she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said unto him, behold, your brother Esau, as touching you, does comfort himself, purposing to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice, arise and flee to Laban, my brother, to Haran, and tarry with him a few days until your brother's fury turn away. Well, that's what he does, and he goes there, and as you know, he, like I said, he's a conniver, and he actually works with the livestock of Laban and comes out having more livestock than the one that he's working for. But anyway, let's notice something else here. In this what we're looking at, turn to the 26th chapter. I want to back up a little bit and notice here verse 34, a little difference here between Jacob and Esau. In the 26th chapter it says, and Esau was 40 years old when he took a wife, Judith, the daughter of Beri the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, which were a grief to the mind of Isaac and to Jacob. Why is that? Well, because he's marrying in the land of Canaan, the ones that Israel was to destroy, all those people. Now, here we have Esau marrying one of them. Let's go over to the 27th. Well, I think we've been there. 28, I guess I want to be now. 28, verse 6. Here again we find what happens. Another hatred. Verse 6. When Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram to take a wife from thence, and that he blessed him, he gave him a charge, saying, "You shall not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan," which Esau had already done. And Jacob obeyed his father and his mother, and was gone to Padan Aram. And Esau, seeing the daughters of Canaan, pleased not Isaac his father. Then went Esau unto Ishmael, and took unto the wives which had Maalat, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife. So here we have Esau marrying not only Ishmaelites, but also marrying the tribes that were to be gotten rid of there in the land of Israel, the Holy Land. I want you to go over with his background. Go to the book of Isaiah. You can see now that Yahweh is not really pleased with Esau. Esau is the one that... And Ishmael are the ones that actually are the fathers of the Arabs today. But in the book of Isaiah, chapter 63, has some more information on for us that we should be aware of, because these things have yet to be fulfilled. Notice in chapter 63, we have from the first six verses the question, who is this that comes from Edom? Dyed with garments from Basra. Basra is also located in the land of Iraq, as you probably know. This that is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength, that is, speaks in righteousness, mighty to save. This is talking about Yahshua. Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel, and your garments like him that treads the wine fat? So he says, I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me, for I will tread them in my fury and trample them in my anger and trample them in my fury, and their blood shall be sprinkled on my garments, and I will stain all my raiment. For the day of vengeance is in mine heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. I looked, and there was none to help, and wondered that there was none to uphold. Therefore mine own arm brought salvation unto me, and my fury upheld me. And I will tread down the people in mine anger, and make them drunk in my fury, and I will bring down their strength to the earth. In the book of Revelation, it talks about the selfsame thing, where Yahshua comes to the wedding supper, and he has blood spattered on his clothes. Apparently, there is something he has to do with Edom and these people even before the marriage ceremony can take place. Exactly what that is, we're not really sure, but it must be something that takes up Yahshua's time. I want you to go over to the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 35. And here again we find that the prophecy is involved in this. And I think we're living in the time on the threshold of even more prophecy being fulfilled. Chapter 35. I wrote a scribbled note on top of my chapter here. I wrote Israel, Arab War Against Edom. I don't know where I got it, but let's take a look at this. Verse 2, Son of man, set your face against Mount Seir. Well, that's Edom, isn't it? And prophesy against it, and say unto it, Thus says Yahweh Elohim, Behold, O Mount Seir, I am against you. I will stretch out mine hand against you. I will make you most desolate. I will lay your cities waste, and you shall be desolate, and you shall know that I am Yahweh. Because you have had perpetual hatred, and have shed blood of the children of Israel by force of the sword in the time of their calamity. In that time, excuse me, that their iniquity has an end. Excuse me. Therefore, verse 6, as I live, says Yahweh Elohim, I will prepare thee unto blood, and blood shall pursue thee. And since you have not hated blood, even blood shall pursue you. I will make Mount Seir most desolate, cut it off from that passeth out of him that returneth, and so on. He goes on to tell what he is going to do. This is all prophetic. Why is this important? Well, it's because the ones that are really involved in all these things going on in our news now are usually blamed on the Islamic people. I was rather interested to notice that our president contends that he was not after the Islamic people, he was after the renegades, the terrorists, which is true. But it's interesting. Well, I want to show you a map. I don't know if you can see this or not, but it's kind of a map I took out of the paper just to give you a brief idea. Most of the people think the people over here in Africa are all Arabs and they're all Islamic. And they must be the greatest, the greatest number of Islamic must live there, but that's not true. The greatest number down here in Indonesia, a bunch of islands down there. And there are over 1 billion people in the Islamic religion. But it is that little group from the nations here that we just read about where most of the trouble comes. The people in Indonesia don't bother us as much as the ones that come out of the parts of Africa and the Middle East. I have a book here called Questions and Answers About Islam, and I think I learned from it. I want to go through part of it and share it with you. A little bit about Islam and what it's all about. In Islam, you don't have to get baptized, don't have to get circumcised, don't have to do anything except say these words. The only deity is Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. That is, you worship only Allah, and his prophet is Muhammad. That's all you have to say. But it's one religion that's been spread by the sword. If you don't say those words, you die. And that went on for a number of years. You probably know that Europe was almost overrun by the what the Catholic Church called Saracens, and they were stopped as they were coming up the Iberian Peninsula in Spain by Charles the Hammer. And he stopped them, Charles Martel. And he stopped them there in Spain, and they never got up into France and some of the other places in their war against the people. The interesting point is that the Islamic people will tell you that they are not warlike people. And they've said that it doesn't teach them in their Quran, which is their Bible that was written by Muhammad, that it says in there nothing about killing people. Well, that's not true. It says if they have an infidel, know of an infidel, who will not follow what they say, they have the right to kill him. I forgot to write that down in the Quran. It also has a lot of other ancillary studies that are passed around to the people that are of the Islamic faith. And in there, they talk all the time about if your enemy doesn't do what you want him to do, you have a right to kill him. And it goes on and on. And yet I'm kind of dumbfounded that our president wouldn't at least mention that. But he doesn't. He doesn't want to cause any waves. He wants to leave it the way it is. And I understand that too. But on the other hand, I think we have to know that the Islamic people have the right, if they want to, if you're classed as an infidel, you better watch out, because the ones that do this the most are the people from the Arab populations, Edomites and so on. I know even the Philippines has some renegades over there that will actually kidnap Americans especially and hold them for a million dollars ransom. And they say, if you don't send us $1 million, we won't. The only way you'll get the person we're holding is he'll be dead. And if they get no answer, in the past what they've done is sent in the heads of a couple of Filipinos and say, we mean business. So anyway, what I'm trying to say that the groups over there have no qualms about doing any killing or whatever they have to do. I want to just kind of give you some statistics here on the Islamic people. I know that we have a number of them here in this country. In fact, we have about 30% of the Islamics are made up here in this country of African Americans. And we have about the same number made up of other races. But yet, I know that when we go to the prisons, that a lot of times we are in, our rival probably is the Islamic meetings that they have. And there are a number of places where they actually hold meetings, and they're given preference over even the, those of Christianity. Anyway, I want to mention here this. It says here that Islam is listed in the World Almanac and Book of Facts as having 1,155,109 adherents worldwide. Christianity has 1,974,181,000 adherents worldwide. And the word Islam itself means submission. It means it's a religion of submission to the will of Allah. And his word, and it's so written in the Quran by Muhammad. Muhammad lived in the year 570 after the Messiah, 570 to 632. And he is the one that wrote down the bits and pieces of the Quran. He wrote it on pieces of wood, scraps of leather. He wrote it on bones, different things. And they collected all of these and put them in a book. And it happened to be the Quran. Should give a little background here, too, because he grew up in Saudi Arabia. He was ousted from Mecca. And he made a pilgrimage to Medina with 70 of his followers in the year 622. And this is supposed to be the beginning of the Islamic religion. We find that, like I mentioned before, the Islamic religion has been in the Middle East, and it goes even up into parts of Africa, even the Soviet Union. In fact, five republics in the Soviet Union are predominantly Islamic. And the minorities are in China, the Philippines, and in India, and some of the countries that are very much Islamic seem to have a hatred for the United States. And actually, reading some of the books, most of the conclusions I've had to draw is it's mainly because Europeans and Americans have a higher standard of living than any of the Islamic people do. And they're probably jealous because we have a higher standard of living, more comforts, more creature comforts, and a lot of those people are, especially in Afghanistan, are living in very humble origins, have nothing really of any means of support. One thing I noticed here, too, it says that most Arabs are followers of Islam. But Arab identity is not determined by religion. Indonesia is the most populous of all Muslim nations, and the people of Indonesia are not Arabs. So we find that the Arabs are the ones that are usually doing the raids and doing the things that they have been doing so far. And it goes back, I believe, to what we just read in the book of Genesis. The beginning of Esau and his family, and Ishmael and his family. A little bit about Muhammad. The Muslims believe that Yahweh revealed the Quran to him. In fact, you know, probably know that the Islamic people are supposed to or said to possess and keep and acknowledge the Old Testament, but they don't acknowledge the New very much, but they go by the Holy Book, and they contend that the religion was given to them by the angel Gabriel, and it was written down by the followers. And what they wrote down is called the Hadith, H-A-D-I-T-H. And they wrote all that down after the death of Muhammad. So what they wrote down and his miracles and so on are questionable because they were wrote down up to 100 years after his death. What happened with Yahshua, they were written down at the very time that he was still alive, or that they were still alive and had talked with him and wrote down the miracles that he did in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and also in the book of John. But the earliest biography of Muhammad is a collection of these hadiths, and they're compiled by a man named Muhammad ibn Ishaq, and he did that in the year 768. They're not in the Quran, but they are traditions about Muhammad and his life and a little history of what he did, his experiences, and we wonder how reliable they really are. John Eldon Williams, who was an Islamic scholar, editor of the volume in the book on Islam, Great Religions of the Modern Man, he wrote, "While Ibn Ishaq was accused in his own time of transmitting false hadiths, his material is of great importance. It is the earliest and presumably the most authentic biography of the Prophet, as well as the most free of miraculous elements plus fabrications. It should be remembered that every individual hadith has to be investigated on its own merits, and Ibn Ishaq was well aware that some of the details were more historic than others." So we have many of the tales, like in the hadith, telling about Muhammad, and yet questions still arise. Are these really true? And the Quran is really the Bible that they are supposed to go by. It's a holy book, and the Muslims believe that it is even letter perfect and was dedicated to Yahweh by Muhammad. The word Quran means recitation. It was given this designation because most of Muhammad's followers, including Muhammad himself, were functionally illiterate. Muhammad could neither read nor write, but he would give these messages, and they were written down on, like I said, on bits of paper, on bits of leather, bones, things like this. The only way they could learn the Quran was by listening to public readings and recitations of its chapters. And the chapters in the Quran are known as surahs, S-U-R-R-A-H. So when you see something that says S in the referring to the Quran, it means the chapter. It is believed that the Quran was revealed to Muhammad surah by surah over a period of about 21 years, often in response to crisis or questions that had arisen in the community of the faithful, and so on. And there's a lot of questions that go into the workings of Muhammad and the things he did and the religious groups and so on. We know that the Bible is much more believable than the Quran. Although when you're talking to people that may be illiterate and they can't read it anyway, they don't really understand why we think the Bible is more valuable and the true one rather than the Quran. We know that the Islamic religion is growing and growing faster than any other religion in the world. In fact, I want to notice here that there's a book called The Spread of Islam by Michael Rogers. And he writes, "From its origin in 622 with Muhammad's flight from Mecca to Medina, within two generations it reached the Atlantic Ocean on one hand and Central Asia on the other. It is no less remarkable for its subsequent grip on all the lands that so quickly it conquered. How do you explain this rapid expansion?" Well, the answer is Muhammad is seen as a person for the common man. His own tribe, the Quraysh tribe, had become rich through trade. They were business opportunists in the Madrush that turned Mecca into a thriving mercantile city. Some of the old tribal values had been lost. Instead of maintaining a sense of community and brotherhood by looking for the weaker members of the tribe, the Korash, they were socially financial climbers. They advanced themselves at the expense of the less fortunate members of the tribe. And this attitude and the resultant iniquities produced a hunger and social reform. And religion was something people looked for. Sometimes the question gets asked, do we really believe that Yahshua is accepted by the Muslims? And the question is, they still will recite this. There is but one G-O-D, Allah is his name, and Muhammad is his prophet. And they believe that Muhammad has more power, more truth than Yahshua because he lived later and he is the last prophet that Yahweh sent. And therefore, they are strong believers in one deity. They claim that Christians believe in three deities, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And they believe that's wrong. For they say that Yahweh is far above all these other ones you're trying to worship. They have a problem with Yahshua, though. They believe he was a good prophet, but he didn't. He's not to be worshipped, not to be given any special honor. The honor is supposed to go to Muhammad. Well, it's quite an interesting thing about Muhammad and the things that he's done. Actually, he married a rich woman. And she was, of course, one of these people that had made money by trading and so on. So he was free to do whatever he wanted, and he roamed the country and kept writing pieces on his to complete the Quran. And that's really what he did. But I want you to notice another verse I wanted to take a quick look at. Let's go to the book of Amos. We could talk about more about Muhammad and so on, but I do think we want to tie this into what we're looking for today in the Bible that would help us understand what might happen and the things that might come to us by way of the history of both Ishmael and Esau. Chapter 1. Here we have in verse 12 a prophecy where Yahweh says, I will send a fire upon Teman, which shall devour the palaces of Bozra. Bozra, of course, is over Well, it's actually up there near Petra and under Saddam Hussein's rule. For thus says Yahweh, for three transgressions and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have ripped up the women with the child of Gilead, that they might enlarge their border. I don't want to read all of this, but the book of Amos continually criticizes the burdens that he bears for the different parts of the world, and some of these are directly to the land over there that we're talking about. But the one I wanted to take a look at is the book of Habakkuk, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk. Habakkuk and Obadiah are two prophecies that very few people really study and get to know much about. But you'll notice that here in Habakkuk, Yahweh speaks beginning there in verse 5, Behold ye among the heathen, and regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days which you will believe, though it be told to you. I will raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. So this is talking about Saddam's place in Iraq. They are terrible and dreadful, Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. Their horses are also swifter than the leopards. They are more fierce than the evening wolves. And their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from afar. They shall fly as the eagle that hasteth to eat. They shall come up for all violence. Their faces shall sup up as the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity as the sand. And they shall scoff at the kings, and the princes shall scorn unto them. They shall deride every stronghold. They will heap dust and take it. Then shall his mind be changed, and he shall pass over and offend, affuting his power unto his mighty one. This is a prophecy of Babylon. The reason it's probably interesting, because you read back in the book of Daniel, in the 11th chapter, that the one that is going to be the man of sin is one who worships war and worships technology. In fact, maybe we should take a look at that. If you want to go to the book of Daniel. Daniel and chapter 11. Sometimes it's kind of hard to get all this put together, but I think we have to keep searching the scriptures, because we know that these things are going to happen, and we want to make sure we understand a little bit about that. In Daniel chapter 11, it talks here about the king shall do according to his will. He shall exalt himself. We're in Daniel 11:36. He shall exalt himself, magnify himself above every deity, shall speak marvelous things against the mighty one of all, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the mighty one of his fathers. Some scholars believe that he will no longer be following Islam. And he will not be the desire of women, nor regard any deity, any Eloah, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the mighty one of forces, and in deity whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and precious stones, pleasant things. So he's going to have a whole new deity that the world has never seen before. And I kind of wondered if maybe some of the bombs and the airplane strikes and so on that our country is delivering over there in Afghanistan aren't these things that this man is going to use to call the nations to follow him. Because it says that he has a strange deity in verse 39, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. And it talks about another king pushing at him. Well, all these things are interesting. I'm trying to follow what's going on today, and what this might lead in the future is a little difficult to say. But the parallel scriptures that we have show that both Babylon and what the Islamic religion is actually a discussion or an ongoing problem that the church, known as the Catholic Church, has had for a number of years trying to take over Jerusalem. And you find that the Catholic Church right now is probably working over there in the areas around Kosovo and in the Yugoslav area. They want to get rid of all of the Islamic people there. Another interesting point is that the prophecies say that the man of sin is someday going to be down in Jerusalem, in that area. And if you know anything about history at all, the early Crusades were primarily to wrest Jerusalem from the hands of the Turks, and primarily the Seljuk Turks, but before that, even away from the Islamic people that had taken over, the Arabs and so on. And it appears that the Catholic Church has not given up their idea of someday being down there and having their hands on Jerusalem, because they know what the book of Revelation says. It talks about Jerusalem being the city of the great king, and that's what they want to do. They want to get over there and take over that part. So we have a lot of prophecy here in the wind, and it looks like we're going to have to keep studying the Bible more and more to figure out what all these things mean and how this is all going to turn out in the end. We certainly know that the Islamic people generally are not warlike, but it seems like Ishmael and Esau are the ones that are over there in the Middle East, and they're the ones that are actually the ones that have been doing some of the greatest terrorizing of various places. So all I can say is that we don't have any solutions yet. We're still hoping and praying that we can figure out some more of these things, what's going to happen. But I do think if we follow Yahshua, do what we're supposed to be doing, obeying him, learning of his ways, that prophecy can go on, and Yahweh will see to it that we're taken care of, that we're doing and learning his ways, and that's what we should be doing.